world turns on a secret axis. The unknown doctors that I'm reading, then I have to talk my spirit masses. The meaning to memory, I figured out the solar system disasters have basically begun. I all miss the rapture, worshiping sun gods. The homework gear, I know it's hard. Amazingly, Western religion is filled with Egyptian magicians. The masons already calculated destruction of the coming of the son of man and assumptions. Now, the pyramids are stolen, the grid from 9-11 that's open the gates to heaven. The art of Moses, like Atom, a decision from Moses. The mention of church's knowledge of being the worthless when I bring my sermon. They dried out like the dead pope, it's like the mafia. So kiss the ground when you see the Colombios slowly stopping ya. It's not the media, it's not encyclopedia, it's the jest of the webs of the protester. Yeah. Gnostic media. You better check your criteria, Gnostic media. You better check your criteria, Gnostic media. You better check your criteria, Gnostic media. And this is the breakdown of East and the pagan, the background. Made it to spring the solarist, you gotta notice. And sacrifice the sins of man, you gotta worship. It goes back to Jesus, but go back to Giza, yo. It lies in Egypt. The sun preaches holy equinox and Syrian God. Astronomical coincidence, I be like, nah. That's where they told you to practice it at all. Nissan, just like they call, the law was defined without a flaw. Christ of Christ, the Buddha coming to your rulers. But really, snakes out their head is looking like Medusa. This like Mithra, the same savior. The Horus, the main concept. The 12th, like the fisher, get the picture. The sun gods, the lamb, the attributes. They try to contribute and try to dispute. But I tried, just like the butte. The kiss of Judas, like the kiss of death on a scorpion. Gemini was Adam and Eve. The planet's now controlling them.
It's Gnostic Media, podcast number 18, and I'm your host, Jan Irvin. And that was Gnostic Media by Sixth Sense. What do we get when a former pastor, former assistant pastor, former minister, and former member of the Cornell University chaplain staff decides to question the historicity of Jesus and the Gospels? Ernest Werner, today's amazing guest, argues that a non-historical Jesus cannot be disproved. Ernest has provided us a fascinating understanding of the way in which the gospel writers weave history, myth, folklore, and legend into one of the world's greatest masterpieces. And for someone coming from the background he does, not only a former believer, but a church leader, he's written one of the most courageous and openly self-reflective pieces I've come across. It takes a lot of openness, honesty, and bravery to do what Werner has done, which is to say that he's questioned and changed his own mind about his own religious devotion and belief. He's the author of The Rod of Jesse on Jesus of the Gospels and Doubt of His Existence, which was published in January 2008. Are the stories that claim Jesus did not exist verifiable? Do they hold merit? Last week, I erroneously stated that Ernest was a minister for 50 years. That was my mistake. He was not a minister for that long. I still haven't figured out who will be on next week's show, so I guess it will be a surprise, but it will likely be either Professor Carl Ruck again discussing his book The Hidden World, Survival of Pagan Shamanic Themes in European Fairy Tales, which, by the way, is one of the best books out there in the entire entheogen scholarship. If those of you who haven't read it yet, you definitely should. Don't believe the poor rankings by people who are unread in this field. It is definitely a top book and a must-have, and it comes with a DVD as well, so make sure you check that out. Also, possibly next week or the week after will be Peter Webster, who has contributed to the 30th anniversary edition of The Road to Ulysses by Gordon Wasson, Albert Hoffman, and also Carl Ruck. And Hoffman's original proposals were put under serious scrutiny over the last couple of decades because of some errors that he made regarding ergotamine. And new evidence and methodology presented by Peter Webster support the original theory. And he'll also be talking about the effect of psychedelic drugs on salience and proposing new theories that seriously challenge Terence McKenna's theory presented in The Food of the Gods on evolution. And this was also updated in the second edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism, which now includes a bit about Peter Webster's information. So check that out. I also need a volunteer to help with the hempforfuel.com website. The person would be in charge of finding fuel and energy related stories and submitting them to the website at least every other day. And that's something that really needs to be kept on top of it. So I need someone who can do that reliably. And the show is run on donations, so if you would like to support this programming, please go to www.gnosticmedia.com and click on the donations button at the top left of the page. The show is not corporate media, and by supporting it, you help continue our programming, and without your help, we cease to be here. I know times are tough, but if you are someone who can afford to support the show by donating a few dollars, then we greatly appreciate it. And what I'm going to do this week is, for those of you who donate $10 or more and who live in the U.S., I will send you a free damaged copy of the second black and white edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism. Basically, what happened is during shipping from the printer last week, and the printer happened to package the books very poorly. And, well, basically what happened was one of the boxes broke open and dumped out an entire case, 38 books, on the floor of the post office. And of those 38 books, 33 were damaged. Either the corners smashed or, pages bent or black marks from the floor, etc. Most of them have only very minor damage, but I can't sell them new. So what the printer requires that I do is cut off the front covers and destroy the books, but there's nothing that says I can't give them away or make a donation to help support Gnostic Media with them, and it seems to me to make a lot more sense to allow people who maybe can't afford a brand new copy of it and still want to get a copy that they can be able to do so instead of just throwing them away or recycling them, which either way is still going to require a lot more resources to process again. So I figure why not give copies out to people who make a donation. And once again, these are going to be without the front cover. I had to cut those off and submit them back to the printer, but this is the entire brand new second black and white edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism, except without the front cover. And these are for USA orders only, please. I will be shipping them out media mail, and there's no way I can afford to do any international orders on this deal because most of the international orders cost between $16-$17 to ship, and I'm only going to do media mail, which is a couple of dollars for shipping. And I still have copies of Astrotheology and Shamanism second color edition available, numbered and signed, and that will come with a free DVD if you order that right away. The DVD is The Pharmacratic Inquisition, and I also have copies of my newest book, The Holy Mushroom, which I will be autographing for you before I send those out, and we could really use your support right now, so please go to www.gnosticmedia.com, and if you would like to contact me directly, you can send me an email at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Enjoy the show. Ernest, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you for coming on. I really appreciate your time. Could you tell me a little bit about your background, where you grew up, and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm essentially a northeastern person born in New Jersey, living in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, New York, and for a couple of years in Massachusetts. But I'm northeast. I did spend, however, 4 years in St. Louis at Concordia Seminary, which is a conservative Lutheran seminary. As far as my life is concerned, I was promised to the ministry very early, too early, at the age of 13. And I began my training for the ministry then, and so I spent 11 years in training, counting a year's internship, for the Lutheran ministry. My whole life has been occupied with religious questions, and I suppose that's one reason why, in the long run, I left the ministry itself. I have more questions than answers, and I'm waiting for some questions from you.
And at the age of 13, that seems awfully young. What took place that drove you into the church at that age?
Well, first of all, in my day, the Lutheran Church, so-called Missouri Synod, which is a very conservative branch of the American Lutheran Church, modeled their educational system on the German system. In Germany, you go to a gymnasium, so-called. It's a kind of super high school consisting of 6 years. And then you're done with your education unless you go to a professional school. I am told that they do not have the typical liberal arts college in Germany. Now, I went away at 13 to a high school and junior college, which was plainly modeled after the German gymnasium. Following that, I'd spent the 4 years at the seminary in St. Louis. So this was on the German model. Now, as to going at such an early age, yes, it wasn't really my choice, but I'm afraid that I had a pastor who was ambitious to send young boys on into the ministry. He worked on my mother, and as it happened, my mother knew that she could not live very long. She had a very severely damaged heart from scarlet fever, and she promised me to the ministry on her deathbed. She died at the age of 33. I went off to school at 13, and that was the beginning of my career.
Would you talk about your church background and your, I guess now they would be former beliefs and teachings? You were a minister for 50 years?
Oh, no. I left the ministry quite a while ago.
Oh, you did?
And I've been writing. Yes, I left the ministry in middle age. But as far as my church background, in the Lutheran Church, you're brought up in a liturgical setting. The worship is very formal. It's laid out. It's quite as formal as in the Episcopal Church or the Catholic. But one difference between the Episcopal worship and the Lutheran is that there's a good deal more singing in the Lutheran Church. And I think really, except for some of the doctrines taught, it's a very impressive kind of service, and it makes a deep impression on the person. So I've been quite deeply shaped by my upbringing, and that shaping, I'm still coping with the shaping. You don't throw that off. You can discard doctrines, you can change your point of view, but you don't escape the fact that you've been shaped a certain way. And I think my upbringing and the long indoctrination in the ministry have shaped me, and so I have to accept myself for what I am now. But I've been out of the ministry since 1965, which is a good long while.
Okay,
and
wow.
But I've been working and writing about these things over the years, you see.
And you also worked
at... Rod of Jesse, what's that?
I was going to say you also worked at Cornell University, or you were on the chaplain
staff
there?
Yes, I was a chaplain at Cornell. I had the first Unitarian Church of Ithaca downtown. It's a little stone church, a very pretty little church. Just at the foot of a hill, and on top of the hill, that's Cornell University. It dominates the top of the hill. I was at the foot, and my congregation was very strongly largely drawn from the Cornell faculty and their families, and also from Ithaca College, which is a much lesser institution, but still a fine little college with a lot of emphasis on music and also communications. So I had a very interesting professional congregation in Ithaca, much in contrast to the industrial Lutheran congregation that I began with in Altoona, Pennsylvania. That was my first church. And there I was in the midst of mostly working people, some professional people in the congregation, as in any community, but mostly working people. So I've had both, the common, ordinary working type and their families, or professors and physicians and lawyers and so forth, two different exposures in the ministry. And I found it interesting but challenging, and the truth of the matter is I just simply developed doubts in the course of being a minister. I developed doubts with respect to some of the doctrines taught, and step by step I laid the doctrines aside.
What was the first step that led you to start questioning your beliefs?
Well, I began to question, of course, in school, and I suppose the first step was simply the impossibility that I ran into as a student reading assignments in the Bible. I mean, we were given assignments to read, and I ran up against the doctrine of verbal inspiration, which presupposes that the Bible is an infallible source of the Word of God, that all the words as such have been inspired, and there can be no error in the Bible. Well, the Bible is not one book, and it's very far from being infallible. It's a library, and its different chapters are in reality different books written over a large span of time by many different people and from different points of view, and you get all that variety in the Bible. So it was impossible for me to stay with verbal inspiration. That was the beginning of my departure. But I went beyond that also, already in seminary, when I discovered that I could not believe that the bread and wine of communion were, as the Lutherans teach, strictly speaking, were in some miraculous sense also the body and blood of Christ. Luther had one foot in the Middle Ages and one foot in the modern world. Like a Catholic, he believed that the wafer and the wine were body and blood of Christ. But like a Calvinist, he also allowed that the bread was after all bread and the wine was after all wine. I couldn't bring these things together. So those were my beginning steps. First of all, discarding verbal inspiration, and then after that, questioning whether the communion was anything more than simply a sacred symbol. And this is my position today. I look on the communion service as a sacred symbol, but not as such as the body and blood of Christ. Those were my beginnings.
Could you talk about your book, The Rod of Jesse?
Oh, well, The Rod of Jesse is, by the way, The Rod of Jesse does not deny the historical life of Jesus. It merely shows that the life has been questioned and shows why it has been questioned. And what I do in the Rod of Jesse is I allow both arguments. I allow the argument of those who say Jesus never did live, that all of this is a myth. Its origins are very obscure. Everyone admits that. We know far too little about the origins of Christianity to be dealing only with fact. When we discuss these things, we are expressing a point of view and a belief. But I don't go so far as to deny that Jesus lived. I merely recognize that we have material that looks to be legendary, material that is plainly mythical. And by the way, the legendary material in the Bible, in the Gospels, the four Gospels, that's our source for Jesus, it reflects an oral tradition, and oral tradition, a word-of-mouth tradition, is the primary source out of which the Gospels have been culled. So that's why the question does arise, you know, did this man live at all, or is it simply a myth that has been passed on down? I examine both sides of that question in my book, Rod of Jesse, and I found it very interesting. I found it fascinating, and where my book, I think, crosses your interests is that in course of reviewing this question, I was led back to a book I had read many years before by John Allegro called The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. Allegro, after many years of deep scholarship and then working on the Dead Sea Scrolls, invited to work on the Dead Sea Scrolls, came to the conclusion, or seemed to come to the conclusion, that the Gospels were written in code not about a man called Jesus, but about a mushroom called Amanita muscaria. Now, I have to admit to you that I know you don't share this viewpoint. I have to admit to you that when I first ran into this idea as a young man, I was in the ministry at the time. or I was no, I was near the ministry at the time. It struck me as absurd because there is really no serious Protestant scholarship that regards the life of Jesus as a mere fiction. There were some Dutch scholars who inclined to that viewpoint. I was unable to read them because their works have not been translated, and I don't read Dutch. There's also a German scholar whose viewpoint I have studied, Bruno Bauer, who was drawn to that viewpoint eventually. But for the most part, the great German scholars have accepted the legendary and the mythical aspect of the Gospels as having arisen from the remembrance of this life, this man, Jesus, presumably of Nazareth, although even that quote has been questioned. Yes, I deal with both sides of the question.
Yeah, and more recently, there have been scholars such as Earl Dougherty and Dr. Robert Price, and then there's a group that meets in California every year and actually votes on what of the Gospels is historical versus unsubstantiated, and I think so far more than 85% of the Gospels have been put into question by this group of scholars. So,
are you referring to the Jesus Seminar?
Yes, exactly.
The Jesus Seminar, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you know?
I know of them. I don't think the Jesus Seminar as such has produced any revolutionary point of view. These things are known. The situation in America is that the pastors and preachers in America, accommodating the people, have not introduced the ordinary laity, have not introduced the laity to the great achievements of European scholarship. It's in Europe that the great scholars have really gone at these questions deeply and radically. And so the function of a group like the Jesus Seminar has really been to mediate scholarship to a public rather than to create original scholarship, although, of course, these men do go over the material on their own and arrive at their own point of view. I give them that. But for the most part, they have simply transmitted to a larger public ideas which are well known in European scholarship, German and French particularly, but and some English.
And in your own book, you certainly give credence when you go through all of what you call the negative arguments against the history of Jesus. You very clearly show in your work that that the unhistorical Jesus arguments are certainly not unfounded. Could you talk about that?
Yes, they're not unfounded because in the question here is not one of fact. The question is one of belief, and the question, how are we to credit, do we credit the particular tales which have survived? You take the question of Jesus' baptism by John the Baptist. We have good historical evidence for the life of John the Baptist, and we know that he appeared, that he caused a popular movement, that he baptized many people. In the Gospels, he also baptizes Jesus. But when the story is told in the Gospels, Jesus enters the Jordan River, is baptized by John, and the heavens split. A dove, the Holy Spirit in the form of a dove, descends upon him, and a voice sounds from heaven, "Thou art my beloved Son, with thee I am well pleased." This voice, by the way, echoing certain sentiments already expressed in the Psalms. The question then is, all right, we have here what looks like a legend. Is there a historical event behind it or not? And then we come to a question of belief. Some believe, yes, it's a legendary exaggeration of an event which occurred. Others say, no, this is plainly a legend. There doesn't have to be any event behind it. So I do allow full credit to the negative argument. But as I say in my book, I do not deny the life of Jesus. I merely say this argument is sound and we should come to terms with it because it makes a difference in our interpretation of the text.
You broke your analysis. Your book, The Rod of Jesse, is basically, in my opinion, it's a literary analysis, just like someone would break down and analyze Shakespeare.
It is a literary analysis, and I look on my book as a literary work rather than a work of technical scholarship, but as a literary work that is informed by scholarship.
Exactly.
Yes, it's a literary analysis.
So the main components of your breakdown are what?
I'm not sure I understand your question. You mean
you break your book down, or the components of your analysis are broken down into myth, legend, history.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Well, the character of many gospel tales, it has the character of legend. But as I say, I'm not sure these really are legends. They look like legends, but the scholars, the best scholars, have determined that this material arises from an oral tradition. And an oral tradition which then comes to be exaggerated and does definitely resemble legend. The basic myth, however, is what Rudolf Bultmann, a great Protestant biblical scholar, is willing to call the Christ myth. He takes that very title over from Arthur Drews, who's one of the negative critics. Drews denied that Jesus ever lived, and he called his book The Christ Myth, meaning by it to negate the life of Jesus. Bultmann accepts the term The Christ Myth as a way of allowing that this aspect of the story does reflect a fundamental myth. The myth itself is that the Christ shall come, that the Messiah shall come. Jesus then fulfills this. He fulfills the prophecy that the Messiah shall come. Messiah is the Hebrew, Christ is the Greek form of the same word, and it means simply the anointed one. Jesus comes, and his ministry, as the Gospels show, was brief and controversial, so that before no very long time, he was apprehended by the Romans and crucified. And then the Christ myth looks upon this puts it in a perspective of sacrifice. He came in order to make the sacrifice. He came in order to die. That's why he was crucified. And in dying this way, he became a substitute. He became a victim a ransom. He became a ransom for humanity in the eyes of God. Therefore, the Heavenly Father, who loves this Son, Jesus, accepts his death as a ransom for the sin and is able to forgive the sin of the world. Now, that structure, that theological structure, and the idea that this Christ then will, having risen from the dead, will return to judge and redeem the whole world, this total structure is the Christ myth. And then Jesus is simply set within that structure. But within that same structure, we do find evidences of history in the Gospels. And one of the main evidences of historical validity are the teachings of Jesus given extensively by Matthew's Gospel and Luke's Gospel, the first Gospel of four, and Luke, the third Gospel. These Gospels specialize in giving us the teachings of Jesus, which scholars refer to under a code word Q, the letter Q, in reference to a German word Quelle, which means source, or Redenquelle, which means the source of the spoken teaching. And these teachings are really quite genuine. There's no question but that they were given by a very wise and discerning a Hebrew teacher of that era. They have been gathered together and offered as the teachings of Jesus, and there does not, although they have been modified by the evangelists, and therefore by tradition, there seems to be no good reason for denying that these go back to Jesus.
So, why the juxtaposition? In other words, how do we reconcile the difference between what you argue is the evidence for his existence versus what you also argue is strong evidence that the ahistoricity arguments are not discountable?
Oh, well, they're not discountable. People have believed in personalities and gods that have never existed. This is very well known. But, for instance, there's a Scandinavian scholar who has pointed out that the Swiss people have a deep belief in the existence of Wilhelm Tell. But he maintains that there isn't a shred of real evidence for the life of Wilhelm Tell. Now, that's relatively recent, much more recent, that is, than the story of Jesus. So, yes, it's not an unreasonable position to say that Jesus is invented because of all the unusual and even fantastic things that he does in the Gospels. He heals people with a touch, with a word. He immediately discerns the thoughts in other people's minds. He is never at a loss when confronting people. He's always on top of the argument. He's always in charge. And there are elements that make him look like a kind of imaginary hero. But as I say, the teachings and the main structure of that life do stand up to the requirements of history. We have here a rabbi appearing in Galilee, that's north of Jerusalem, in Galilee, gathering disciples, giving them teachings, some of which are in the form of well-known parables, little tales, little illustrations, gathering disciples, traveling to Jerusalem at a crucial time, a crucial service, the Passover season, and being involved in controversy in Jerusalem and getting himself crucified, after which his disciples come to the belief that he has risen from the dead, a belief which we could trace to their own visions, to their sincere belief that he had been raised from the dead. So it is possible to affirm the historical life on the same basis. In other words, I think my argument means this. You talk about bridging the juxtaposition. I think my argument is that there's a basic ambiguity in the gospel material. You can look at it from the perspective of a skeptic. You can look at it from the perspective of one who believes in the essential reality of the man. And I think that both perspectives have something to recommend them. I don't mean to be straddling an issue, because my own conclusion at the end of the book is, yes, there is a Jesus here, but we are not going to find him as a historical personality. That's a fine point, and maybe that's the point you're reaching for, and which I've come to realize. At
this go ahead.
That we are not going to discover the historical Jesus as a historical personality. We can only approach the historical Jesus through these very legends, through this very myth. This contains him, if anything does. And I'm saying, yes, there is a plausible life here, but we aren't going to get this life shed of the legendary or shed of the mythical material. It is presented this way, and there's no way to pluck the historical Jesus out of the Gospels, as scholars have been trying in vain to do for already now a couple of centuries. And by the way, the results of that effort show a great variety of opinions. And it is because the scholars cannot really reach agreement as to just what the historical Jesus was or did, that I'm saying you have to take the Gospels as they are, as the evidence of the historical Jesus. You're not going to be able to pluck him out and discard the rest.
I believe in your book that's what you call the mythic Jesus as hero archetype.
Well, yes, there definitely is archetype. I don't know if Rod of Jesse actually mentions hero. I don't know if the word hero occurs. I certainly do believe that in what Jung calls the hero myth, and that this also involves an archetype. What is your question then? Is it a question about the archetype or whether Christ is an archetype?
Well, I was just asking, I think that's the correlation you make in your book by bridging these two juxtaposed positions is really this mythic Jesus archetype figure. It's really the whole point of the story is the message and not trying to force a literal interpretation, etc., out of the story. That's where I was trying to go with that.
But I think you're quite correct when you say that. The Gospels are not really interested in giving us historical data as such. They do affirm the history, but they are interested in getting this message across. They're interested in the interpretation more than in the mere event. The event without interpretation would have little meaning for them. They insist on the interpretation, and that's where the hero myth comes in. That's where the gospel myth comes in, yes. The emphasis is on interpretation and message. And the message is, here is your Redeemer. Here is the very image of the new life. This is the new life which we ourselves may have, as the Bible says, in Christ. We receive Christ in baptism. We receive Christ in the Holy Communion by accepting the wafer and the wine. This is my body, according to the story that is told. This is the New Testament in my blood, the New Covenant in my blood. Whether Jesus actually said these words, you see, is historical a problem. Many a Jewish scholar doesn't believe he ever said those words at all, and I must admit that I'm skeptical about those words, the words of institution. The communion service in itself is a kind of enacted myth, but it is a myth with deep meaning, and the Christians who participate in it believingly really have the experience of receiving Christ as a living, cleansing spirit within themselves and as a friend, and that experience is very much at the heart of Christian faith, that one becomes a friend of Jesus and associated with Jesus, and in the words of Saint Paul, we put on Christ. And he doesn't mean we put on a show, put on in that sense. He means we put Christ on ourselves, and he becomes, he merges with our spirit, and we are purified thereby. It's very mystical.
And I can think of quite a few evangelicals who have adopted those themes and seem to think that they are a part of the chosen few who have accepted Christ and then go around and try and force very narrow and limited points of view onto others.
Yes, that is really very unfortunate, and I have to admit that my book, Rod of Jesse, is written from the perspective of a man who has taken a seriously critical attitude toward the popular religion of today. The popular Protestant movement in America, I don't want to judge the Catholics because I don't know enough about Catholics. I have known Catholics and priests and so on, but I'm not deeply acquainted with Catholicism as I am with the Protestant churches. I think that there's a good deal of degradation in American religion. And I think American religion needs a purging. That, in fact, that is one of the aims of my own book, Rod of Jesse. I think that pastors who read Rod of Jesse and take it seriously will, it is my belief, they'll have an experience. They will see things which they have been overlooking, and they will be awakened to urgencies which they have been neglecting. But so my book is critical in that sense. But I don't make a point of lambasting churches or anything like that. I certainly don't wish to disturb people in their faith. Even simple-minded believers who believe things in a literal way, I'm not interested in upsetting their faith. If people are capable of higher thoughts, they will arrive at these thoughts on their own.
Very interesting. Earlier you mentioned John the Baptist as being a historical
Yes.
character and provable in history. Are you aware of the Mandaeans and their belief systems? They're an ancient group in Iraq.
Yes, I am aware of them.
Oh, okay. Have you mm-hmm. read any of their books?
No. I don't even know that those books are translated. I think you have to learn the language to read the books. But I have read about them. And in particular, and I go into that in Rod of Jesse in one place. Yes, these are compulsive baptizers. They believe today, I don't know how many have survived the ravages in Iraq and Iran right now, but they believe themselves to be descended from John the Baptist. They are not very favorable toward Jesus. They feel that Jesus weakened the message of John the Baptist.
Right, well, they actually argue... Their texts actually say directly that Jesus is a false prophet. You can actually read, some of the texts have been translated.
You can read that,
is
that right?
Right, in I think Eduardo Lupieri's book on the Mandaeans discusses or translates some of their texts.
Oh, that's interesting. That's very interesting. I must admit I didn't know about that book. But I have read about the Mandaeans, and I know they don't think very highly of Jesus. It's interesting that there are Protestant scholars who believe that the Mandaeans are deceived about their own origin and that they themselves are heretical Christian. I'm not ready to take up that point of view, but there are scholars who make that argument. I am aware of them and of the view they take. But they remain a sect, and I don't think that there's any real future to that religion. They belong to themselves, and as long as they survive living by the river, they have to have flowing water. They have to live near the river, because they're constantly being rebaptized over and over again.
Exactly,
it's just a necessity. Yeah.
You felt and we talked about Allegro earlier. You felt originally that Allegro's theory about the mushrooms in Christianity was absurd, and his ideas of fertility cults was pornographic. Do you still feel that way?
I don't consider that I didn't use the word pornographic in Rod of Jesse, and I don't think that is an accurate reflection of my viewpoint. What I do say is that Allegro's emphasis, Allegro's treatment of the mushroom is at the same time very heavily freighted with sexual reference. He refers to the phallic appearance of it. He derives phallic images and also a cross image from the mushroom. And in some respects, he also gets into the female aspect of possible resemblances. But the point is that I make in my book, Rod of Jesse, is that Allegro's Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, published in 1970, looks like an effort to attract people to the idea which would have been popular around the 70s, of Christianity as a sex and drug cult. Sex and drugs somehow seem to be mixed together in the popular culture, those who know anything about it. I myself have never had any drugs. I don't know anything about them at first hand. But sex and drug cult seems to be in his mind as a model of the possible origins of the Christian faith. And the reason why this strikes me as absurd, I spent my whole life in upbringing in being indoctrinated and initiated and trained and educated and all of these things, and no one ever had the least glimmering of it. There just isn't the faintest idea. It's strange that it would begin this way, and yet the knowledge of it die out completely. That's one thing I find very hard to accept.
Well, in my own studies, I've actually come across at least several dozen scholars who, since the mid-1700s, have actually published very similar theses to Allegra's regarding the fertility of Judeo-Christianity. And there's a very good book, Erotica Judaica, by Alan Edwardes, for instance, and another very good one from the 1800s by Thomas Inman called Ancient Pagan and Modern Christian Symbolism, that actually covers these sort of concepts in detail with a lot of the old symbolism and things like that. And certainly in my own studies, I have come across enough of this type of evidence to begin working on an entire book that shows that area of research.
Do you have a title for this new book of yours?
Well,
or are you just gathering material?
Tentatively speaking, I mean, calling it Religion, Sex, and Psychedelics, but I have not...
Go ahead. That's based a theme. Well, now, you see, Ronald Jesse accepts the challenge of Allegro on these grounds, however. I first of all, I don't deny at all that there is an ancient fertility. It isn't so much a sex cult as there are fertility elements deeply embedded in the ancient history. I don't think that at the time of Jesus, that is the time when he is supposed to have lived, I don't think that at this time there is any active fertility element left in the Jewish practice or that there would any fertility practice done by the Christians at that time.
Well, I would.
The question is whether.
I was going to say I would argue against that the very practice of circumcision itself by Jews in designating themselves by severing the ends of their penises is in fact a direct relation to fertility worship, and then also, the Star of David itself, the upward triangle is female and the downward triangle is male. And just the very symbol of the designation of the religion is in and of itself a fertility symbol.
All right. Well, that's news to me. I haven't heard that. But I wouldn't object to that as a theory. And I'm certainly not forgetting that the practice of circumcision, in fact, the Gospels themselves. Luke's Gospel mentions that Jesus was circumcised on the eighth day, as the Jewish law requires. And by the way, an important little detail like that shows the conviction of the evangelist that this baby was a genuine human being and a Jew, and it establishes his ethnic identity. By that action, his parents carrying out the law with respect to their firstborn child. But no, I'm not denying that there are survivals of the fertility cults. And you know, in a section of my book which I call the Lazarus Excursus, and which I regard as actually a very important section, and to speak quite frankly, very deep, the Lazarus Excursus takes up the whole challenge of Allegro in the matter of his you might call his sex interest in this connection. And I try to show that all the phallic material that he would associate with the mushroom can really be transferred to the myth of Lazarus not in any gross or visible way, but simply through association with ancient religion, especially the Osiris cult in Egypt, which is hundreds and hundreds of years older than Christianity, and but also with modern psychology, which is aware of unconscious phallic identifications, which some deranged and unfortunate minds arrive at, people actually thinking of themselves in phallic terms. And I try to cope with Allegro on those grounds. A person may or may not regard my treatment as successful. I myself think it is a successful response to the challenge of Allegro.
And
So I
was just going to say, I was glad that you brought up Lazarus. I was hoping that you could actually go into that in more detail and what you found there.
In this Lazarus excursus, I have tried to respond to the challenge of Allegro with respect to the element of survival of the ancient fertility cults in unconscious symbolic ways in the later religion. And I think that a survival can be found in the story of Lazarus being raised from the dead. Lazarus, insofar, resembles the god Osiris, who is also wrapped up like a mummy, as Lazarus is wrapped up like a mummy. And when Jesus calls Lazarus forth from the grave, calling in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth," it is a reminder of the resurrection of Osiris, who is raised not back to life in this world, but raised to life in the underworld, where he becomes a judge. And I show how these parallels can be traced out in some detail, and I suggest that in an unconscious way or in a symbolic way, Lazarus can be made to carry this value, this Osiris value. But I don't limit it to merely comparing Lazarus and Osiris. I show that the Lazarus image has actually taken on phallic overtones in some treatments, some artistic treatments. And I show, too, that there is a type of psychoanalytic analysis, and not even psychoanalytic, but just simply pure psychiatry, which is aware of a phallic fantasy that some minds fall into. And in bringing this material together, it's very hard to talk about it in brief. And in fact, I feel that I'm not making a very good case in brief. But anyone who reads the section in my book called The Lazarus Excursus will see that I've done a very thorough job of it. And I believe that this is a good response to Allegro's implicit challenge that we must come to terms with the fertility element in Christianity, as well as with the visionary, the revelations which he would attribute to the mushroom. But I myself believe that you can have visions, the sense of revelation, quite apart from mushrooms or from any kind of a drug.
And let me ask you this. What is the rod or the tree of Jesse, and why is that significant enough to name the title of your book after it?
The rod of Jesse, first of all, is actually taken from the Old Testament prophecy in which Israel has suffered devastation, terrible devastation. But the devastation resembling that of a tree which has been cut down, but is not killed by this cutting down, this devastation. The Assyrians and the Babylonians and so forth have devastated the Hebrew tribes. But out of the cut down trunk, a rod springs up. The tree renews itself. And this rod is called the rod of Jesse, because Jesse is the father of David, who founded the first, who really founded the original successful Hebrew kingdom. Saul was the first king, but David was the warrior king who made Israel great in the first place. And the rod of Jesse is therefore an anticipation of a Davidic king to come. Another person like David who will restore the kingdom is compared to this shoot which grows out of the cut down tree, and this shoot will renew the tree, and the rod of Jesse, the offspring of Jesse, namely David, the new Davidic king, will renew Israel. At the same time, rod of Jesse is, from the point of view of a Freudian interpretation, is a phallic reference. Rod itself, simply rod itself, is a phallic reference, and I don't deny that element of phallic reference is built into the title of the book.
In fact, I've got many art interpretations that show the rod of Jesse coming directly out of the groin area, and in fact,
you do have. I know that's in your book, The Holy Mushroom, which, by the way, is nicely illustrated, but that illustration is there. However, it reminds me of an illustration that used to be on the cover of Alan Watts's book. And is it the same illustration? Is it the same picture? I can't remember right now.
I'm not sure. I don't know about that particular version of Alan Watts' books.
Okay, on one of his paperbacks, there is indeed a tree of Jesse growing out of his loins, out of his the genital area, and the various descendants of Jesse and leading up to Christ are in the branches somehow. That's where the tree growing out, the rod of Jesse growing out, grows out of the loins of Jesse. It's a strange image in a way, because it combines the metaphor of a tree with the generative power, how would one call it, the generational power.
Exactly.
of Jesse. It's very interesting. It's an interesting symbol.
Yeah, that's the one in my book, The Holy Mushroom, is actually taken from the Winchester Bible.
Okay.
And,
okay, fine.
That one's about,
and that's probably where Alan Watts got it too, as far as I know. But sure. Oh yeah, the Christian imagination has been very versatile. There's no question of that.
So why question the historicity of Jesus? Would you not be considered an antichrist if you question Christ's existence?
Well, I don't aspire to be an antichrist. As a matter of fact, I have to say. Now I have a great admiration for Friedrich Nietzsche, who did actually call himself, in a half serious way, as he became increasingly mad, he signed himself the Antichrist. But I don't aspire to anything like that. And I have to say, actually, for me personally, in spite of all that I've written and gone through, I have to say Jesus remains a sacred figure for me. For me personally. Jesus remains a sacred figure. I don't forget that or deny it, but I do feel that one has to come to terms with all these historical and intellectual questions, and one has to face up to these doubts. But no, to be an antichrist, I have no wish to take such a stance. What I would like to see, a purging of the churches from within. American churches are shallow, they're confused, the laity are ignorant compared with the laity in more religious ages. When America was being founded and people read the Bible and so forth, they knew something about their own religion. Today, there are a great many people, even churchgoers and so forth, who know very little about their own religion. And I would like to see a renewal in those respects. I'm not opposed to myth, I think myth, as such, is a necessary human language, and when you come to the necessity of communicating with large numbers of people, with publics, you are almost driven to a mythic expression. People, the publics, you can't approach the public as such, as a rational philosopher, and expect to get anywhere. People are not up to the level of rational philosophy by and large. You have to deal with the public on the public's own terms.
Very well said.
Does that sound benighted?
Right. No, not at all.
Okay, good.
Would you have anything in particular to say to Christian fanatics who would call you or make such accusations that you're the Antichrist or anything? Is that how would you answer to somebody that would say something like that?
I had some experience as a young Lutheran pastor already with people who became very upset with things I was saying already at that time. And within the framework of the Lutheran religion still, I was accused of this and that, and called a Pharisee, and called a liberal, which in those days and in my place was a terrible thing to be called. But I don't think I would, basically I don't think I would care to respond very much. I would just hope that they didn't start throwing things and make my exit. I don't have much to say to people, you know, who take a viewpoint like that.
That's a good point to take, or a good view to have. And if you had one thing that you would like members of the audience to remember from this interview, what would that be?
Well, I think the point that I would like to people to realize is that your interests and mine, even though we take different points of view about the sacred mushroom, are in a way they resemble the traffic at a crossroad. And your road goes in one direction and my road goes in another. But these roads do cross. And that point of interest, I think, should be retained.
And that's why I wanted to have you on the show, because I think that you have contributed valuably to research, and I wanted to make sure that the audience got a chance to hear your side of things, and not necessarily the other side, but a different side of things that my show normally wouldn't give. In this particular field, especially in studying and theogens and things like that, usually the shows are focused around that area. But, you know, it is nice to have somebody on where we know where our points of agreement and disagreement are, and we can look at each other and say, okay, well, we agree on this, this, and that, and here's the evidence for this. And a lot of the points do work within both, but at the same time, it's also a way that we can look at each other's work and say, here's where we can go from here, and here are the new directions that we've created by meeting in this crossroad.
Yes, I think that's very well said. I agree with you. And so thank you for the interview.
And thank you for coming on, and would you like to give out the name of your book again, and any contact information or anything you might want to provide?
Well, Rod of Jesse is the title of the book. The subtitle is, what is the subtitle of my book? It's right here. On the Jesus of the Gospels and Doubt of His Existence, I examine the question. Unfortunately, my book is only available through the internet, but it's easily found on the internet, and I would simply invite people to look it up by that title, Rod of Jesse. You can even get to the website by putting Rod of Jesse all in one word .com, and you have a survey of the book, a very complete list of the chapters in it, and the opportunity to buy it if you are so inclined. I hope some people may be.
And I hope they will
too.
I've actually been encouraging listeners to buy your book for the last 3 or 4 weeks before the show so that they could prepare to have you on. Who knows if anyone did or not, but hopefully if they haven't yet, they will now.
And well, thank you, Mr. Urban.
You're welcome, Mr. Werner. And once again, thank you for coming on. And this concludes podcast number 18. Thanks for tuning in.